And now, Talk Radio 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money, Not Theirs, with your hosts Richard Musio and Joe Vecchio. Now, here are Richard and Joe.
Good evening and welcome to another installment of It's Your Money, Not Theirs. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host and announcer, and boy, what a difference a week makes. I remember last Sunday it was cold and rainy and stormy, and today a picture-perfect ideal day in San Diego, aside from the Chargers game. But in any event, I would like to introduce my other co-host, Richard Musio, CPA and family office guy, who is fresh off the two half marathons and the turkey trot up in Oceanside. Good evening, Richard.
Joe, how you doing? Did you have a great Thanksgiving?
Well, I did. I'm still getting over a little GI problem, but so I didn't put too much weight on. That's the good news.
Well, that's good. Maybe you got to eat some turkey. I know a couple weeks ago you were not looking good, my friend.
No, I'm a lot better now.
Good. Good. So anyhow, to give you a quick summary of the Oceanside Turkey Trot, we had over 8,000 runners out there, had over 12,000 people at the finish line, raised over $50,000 for Oceanside charities, primarily the public school system up in Oceanside. It didn't even come close to raining, which is great. I ran the 5-miler for Sirius, then I ran the 5K at 8:30 in a turkey costume. So that was a lot of fun. I got my picture on the front page of the second section of the North County Times. So
yeah, I saw that. You had plenty of great TV coverage.
So there's a lot of people out there going, I can't believe I do business with that turkey. But it was a total success. So
yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, we had a great show last week with Kathy Kinane, your executive director and who hosts the event. I thought she was great. So it's nice to see that people are. I see more people getting back into running, I think, and you know, our health is important. So
yeah, it was a great day all around on Thanksgiving. So we moved our feet before we ate.
By the way, Thanksgiving night, I did happen to flip on CNBC, and I did watch our initial guest, Bill Larrack, on Enron, the smartest guys in the room. They run that movie, that documentary, all the time, and it's always worth watching again. You always pick up a few more little details and items. It was a great film. So,
but we've got a guest who's going to be talking about something similar, don't we, Joe?
Yes, we do. Tonight, we've got a very special guest, very notable attorney, Gary J. Aguirre, who had quite a distinguished career as a class action attorney himself, and then went on to become an investigator with the SEC and got in trouble. Why? For doing his job. And we'll get into more of that in details in his history in a little bit. So,
and I think we're going to talk about some rather interesting failures or collapses in the market that he's been involved, not causing the collapse, but rather from an investigative perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bear Stearns, we're going to talk about Bear Stearns tonight, right, Gary?
I think it's on the agenda.
It's on the agenda? All right. Well, why don't you introduce yourself ever so briefly, Gary? Let everybody know who you are.
Well, gentlemen, I'm glad to be here. San Diego's my hometown, and so it's a pleasure to be here with you this evening.
Thank you. Great to have you here.
And we're looking for a song, because Gary has a son who's a rather well-known musician, Gary Jules, who did the cover of Tears for Fears' Mad World. And I'm trying to get Justin to play that, you know, leading in, but my co-host Joe Vecchio says it's too slow.
Well, we'll go out on, if you could find it, Justin, on one of the breaks, we'll go out. He just gave us a thumbs up.
So all right, Justin, way to go, man.
That's a good sign.
It's Gary Jules' cover of Mad World by Tears for Fears.
Please don't ask me to hum any part of it.
Okay.
I can't get two notes in order.
That's okay. When I did see Gary, you've got quite an alphabet soup after your name. You've got a couple of law degrees, an MFA, and a master, and everything else. So maybe you can give us a little history on your legal background, and then how this launched into what you discovered at the SEC. What do you think of that?
Okay. Well, in some ways, I had more or less the conventional experience in law. I began with a public defender and cut my teeth there, then started doing civil cases in San Diego, eventually moved on to class actions, and focused on those until about 1995. At that point, I entered a long-term midlife crisis that extended for, I don't know, almost a decade. It took me to Europe and to do some other things. I got back into the law in 2004, But before doing so, I went back to law school to get some new tools. Went to Washington and got another degree focused on securities regulation and international law. And from there, moved on to the SEC in 2004.
But just for our listeners, your degrees were from Berkeley, UC Berkeley School of Law, UCLA, and Georgetown for this last degree, right?
So, correct.
So that's those, you know, pretty reputable organizations, I'd have to say.
A bit underfunded, some of them now.
Yeah, most universities are underfunded these days. It's a function of the economy, even though I think Black Friday set a record with, what, $11 billion of sales. So look, can I read something interesting here? Because I want to start with July in 2004. It says here, Aguirre entered public service as a senior counsel at the SEC Division of Enforcement in Washington, D.C. A routine check of Wall Street trades flagged unusually heavy stock purchases by a company called Pequot Capital Management, a hedge fund. We're going to talk a little bit more tonight about what hedge funds are. And this investment was in a company called Heller Financial back in July of 2001, which was bought by GE, that's General Electric Capital, shortly thereafter earning Pequot, this hedge fund, $18 million inside of a month. And Gary Aguirre was made the lead investigator on this case. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Well, yes. Shortly after I got to the SEC, in fact, a couple of days later, I was handed a file involved preliminary investigation into Pequot Hedge Fund, which had at one point been the largest hedge fund in the world. And as I mentioned, I'd done some criminal defense, and normally the first thing you do in criminal cases is to check to see if there's any other priors. So I began checking around the SEC, and it was no simple task to find out whether Pequot had priors. But as I looked, I kept finding more and more cases that had been referred into the SEC involving the same hedge fund and suspected insider trading. There were a number of referrals from the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, and other SROs in which the investigators, the market surveillance units of those institutions, had conducted preliminary investigations, didn't like the answers they got, sent it over to the SEC, where these files had gathered dust. So by October of 04, I'd found about 15 or 16 of these files. And then I began interviewing some of the people at the SROs, for example, the New York Stock Exchange, the Market Surveillance Unit. And they flatly told me that there were a number of large hedge funds which appeared to have connections with Wall Street banks and were getting tips. So they referred other cases to me, and by the early 2005, I had something like 22 of these cases on Pequot. And I started searching through those and sending out subpoenas, and eventually, by the summer of 2005, two of them stood out. One involved the case that you just mentioned, Heller Financial, in where the CEO of Pequot in 2001, when Pequot was the largest hedge fund in the world, had one day decided to begin purchasing Heller Financial stock. And during July of 2001, he caused Pequot to purchase more Heller Financial stock than any other institution or person in the country. There were times during that month that he attempted to purchase several times the amount of stock that was available, which all seemed peculiar because when we started looking into the records, there was no apparent reason for his decision to start buying the stock. There were no studies of the company. There were no emails about the company. There were no research reports about the company. There were no meetings about the company. It was just a void. It seemed that on July 2nd, 2001, he woke up and there was a voice that said, buy Heller Financial. That was one of the cases. The other one was a second case we were looking at that the investigation had narrowed down to on the short term, involved somewhat similar transactions in Microsoft. But there was more of a pattern there. There were more documents. In this case, he had begun purchasing Microsoft stock in early April of 2001, and we were able to track the events leading up to that point. He had tentatively hired someone in Microsoft to join Pequot, and in early April, he wrote, sent an email to this person, his name is David Zilka, asking Mr. Zilka for tidbits.
Great. Why don't we hold that thought? We'll come right back to this timeline right after this short break. And this song does sound familiar.
Bright and early for the daily races, going nowhere, going.
Good evening. Welcome back to It's Your Monday, Not Theirs. We're back in studio with our special guest, Gary Aguirre, and my co-host, Richard Muzio. And let's get back to the dialogue.
Yeah, so we're talking about, well, the name of the show again is It's Your Money, Not Theirs, but we were making the comment during the break that if you are, you know, investing with a hedge fund, it might be their money and not yours, even though it originally was your money. So anyway, you get some anonymous calls and some information, and then you find out there's a hard drive, and you ask somebody to check to see what kind of correspondence might have occurred on April 7th, 8th, or 9th of, I guess it was 2001, right?
Correct. Actually, what I was asking is, do you have any emails by Zilka to or from somebody inside of Microsoft seeking information about the earnings? And a couple of weeks later, I get a call back from my anonymous source, and he says, I found this email. Let me read it to you. It's pretty concise, and it says, it was an email from Zilka to somebody else asking for information on earnings that had just closed. And the email came back, said, just had our best March ever. It named a system that was selling like hotcakes. We've got the U.S. turned around and we're revising, which meant revising upward. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have written an email that more clearly stated what you think of as material non-public information. Nobody knew that. Everybody, Bill Gates was refusing to comment on the earnings. The analysts were convinced that Microsoft was going to miss its earnings. So this was dynamite.
This is a smoking gun 101, right?
So I passed it along to Senate investigators. The anonymous source wanted to make certain that the SEC opened an investigation and asked, well, how do we do this? And I said, well, perhaps the best way is to have the SEC read about it in a newspaper. So I turned the document. So I turned the document over to the Senate, the investigators who had conducted the investigation, and to the FBI. And very soon it popped up in the Washington Post, and the SEC immediately opened an investigation. A few months later, the hedge fund imploded. And a year later, they finally paid off $28 million to settle it.
Huh. And then when were you fired?
That happened on July 1st, 2005. Hmm. I had just gotten rather extraordinary because I had just gotten a two-step merit pay raise and very positive evaluation of my work for the last year. And I sent an email to my supervisors saying that I had concerns because of statements to me that we could not take the testimony of John Mack, who was the incoming CEO of Morgan Stanley at that time, because of his powerful political connections.
And this goes back to the Heller matter, right, with John Mack?
Yes.
Okay.
And within, later, the SEC, the Senate opened an investigation. It went 18 months long. They subpoenaed all of the people from the SEC, and the bottom line is that my email raising this issue happened to go out a half hour after The SEC had passed along the recommendation that I get this two-step merit pay raise. I actually got my raise after I was fired.
Oh, my God.
My first check, my next check from the SEC, that's how I found out I got the raise, because the next check that came in from the SEC was a raise. And I thought, how the hell did that happen?
Weren't you on vacation when you got the call?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was out in San Diego. They, you know, when I raised this question, they said, well, hey, relax. Look, why don't you go out, go on vacation, and when you get back, we'll take a look at the evidence that you have on Mac. Now, what I'd found is that this magic about how the heavens had opened up until Sandberg to start buying Heller might have an answer other than a divine intervention. He had talked to Mac the Friday evening before the Monday he began buying the stock. Mac had just got back from 3 days in Switzerland, where he had met with the upper echelon of Credit Suisse, who was representing Heller Financial in the transaction. And we'd also learned that there appeared to be a quid pro quo running from the hedge fund to Mac. So that's why I had suggested that we should take his statement. And initially, my supervisors were in favor of it. In fact, they wanted to open a criminal investigation. So we went to New York, and the FBI and the U.S. attorney there, you know, started ramping up a criminal investigation. And at that point, unbeknownst to me, there was another track going. And that other track was that Morgan Stanley was getting ready to hire Mac as its CEO. And that wasn't going to fly if Mac came in with an SEC investigation as a tail. So the SEC investigation had to disappear. So the instructions came from the top down that, you know, that this was going to stop.
And John Mack, by the way, was a major contributor to the 2004 presidential campaign of George W. Bush. So he was very politically well connected from everything that I've read.
He was also on the short list to become the treasurer. He and Paulson were on the short list, and eventually it was Paulson. But he was on the short list to be treasurer around 2002.
Wow. I don't have a dog in this fight. I mean, if I have no sympathy for a guy like Corzine either, you know, and he happens to be the Democratic variety. But
that's a reference, by the way, to MF Global, the major collapse about a month ago.
Right. I mean, if they're involved in criminal fraud on Wall Street, I don't care what party they are, they should be prosecuted. And I think that's what has a lot of people upset, is none of the major players are getting prosecuted. And people who are pursuing them, like yourself, get punished. But ultimately, you got some kind of vindication. Let's talk about your settlement.
Well, it happened. Just to follow up on that comment, though, I think you're dead right. Neither party has a monopoly on protecting Wall Street. The Democrats do it just as well as the Republicans. In fact, each of them seem to improve on the other. As we move on. Well, what happened in my case is that two senators jumped into this. Some folks put me in contact with Senator Grassley, and then there was later a hearing involving Senator Spector, and he jumped in. And at the time, they were chairman of two powerful Senate committees. And they conducted an 18-month investigation involving, 30 examinations of SEC employees, 10,000 documents, and concluded that the SEC had been deferential to Mac. That had it been somebody else, they would have taken his examination, and that I was fired for pushing back to take his examination. As I think they said that it was a process of reprisal that began when I started pushing to take Mac's testimony. And then there was a U.S. District Court case that reached the same conclusion, and three federal agencies, including the SEC's own Inspector General, reached the conclusion that I was fired for trying to investigate Mac.
Hmm. But then you did get a pretty nice settlement ultimately, right?
Actually, I did. that settlement after the Pequot case, after the SEC closed the Pequot case and this anonymous informant came to me, and I provided the information to the Senate and the FBI. They reopened the case. Pequot collapsed. They eventually settled the case based on the information that I had originally dug up in 2005 involving the insider information passed along by Zucca to Sandberg. And then shortly after that, the SEC settled with me for my salary for I think 5 years and my attorney's fees.
Right. So is the SEC supposed to protect consumers from Wall Street, or is it supposed to protect Wall Street from consumers? That's my question.
Well, that's a great question, because it was created to protect investors from Wall Street. I mean, Wall Street nailed us in the late 20s. They in very similar ways, by the way. They created this extraordinary structure of leverage and based on leverage and speculation, mm-hmm. and then you could think of it almost as a high-rise building with minimal structure, and then this high-rise building is compromised by fraud and market abuse, so that when people begin to get the sense of what it really is, it collapsed,
mm-hmm.
and essentially what what came of that is a study, an investigation by Ferdinand Pecora, and the creation of the SEC in 1934, and which Pecora referred to as the cop on Wall Street, and that cop on Wall Street was supposed to keep an eye on the big banks and hedge funds, which were very similar in one sense to the big pools of money, mm-hmm. in the 1920s, mm-hmm. and what happened. Is eventually, I think, the SEC has been compromised. There's the door between the SEC and Wall Street is in constant rotation, particularly at the top, where the enforcement director will rotate into a bank and then a new one will come in. And it's the same thing going on at the general counsel's office and pervasive at the upper ends of the SEC.
And to give people an idea, their salaries can go from, let's say, $200,000 with the government up to, like, $2 million with a bank?
Well, actually, $2 million is more or less the starting salary.
Oh, gee.
Okay.
That's before bonuses, Joe.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, excuse me.
I mean, we'll leave an unnamed, but one of the people that were involved in stopping the Mack investigation later followed Mack to Morgan Stanley, the attorney who was a former director,
mm-hmm.
of the enforcement division at the SEC. And when he followed Mack to Morgan Stanley just after the investigation was stopped, he got a signing bonus of $13.8
million. Oh, jeez. Oh. And they talk about athletes.
And this is in 2005 money.
Wow. Wow. Amazing.
We're going to talk about Bear Stearns when we come back, right?
That's right. Let's take a little break right now, and we'll get into Bear Stearns right after this short. All right. We are back with It's Your Money, Not Theirs, with Richard Musio, myself, and our special guest, Gary Aguirre. Let's get right back to our discussion on this mystery on Wall Street and where all this money's going.
We want to talk a little bit about Bear Stearns because our guest wrote a very interesting letter to a couple of senators back in 2008, to Senator Christopher Dodd and Senator Richard Shelby, and it has to do with subprime debt. And let me read part of this letter. Significantly, 3 years ago, which would be 2005, the SEC was conducting an investigation that could have averted the subprime debt crisis. The investigation focused on Bear Stearns' evaluation of subprime debt, the core issue in the current crisis. The investigation reached a point where Bear Stearns was told it would be charged. Then, for no known reason, the investigation was switched off. A recent Wall Street Journal article, this would be in 2008, suggests that the effective prosecution of the Bear Stearns case might have averted the subprime crisis. And then it's mentioned that this is very similar to the SEC investigations that were dropped on Pequot. And of course, Bear Stearns ended up combusting, much like the Chargers in the fourth quarter of every game. You know what's going to happen? Well, the same thing happened to Bear Stearns. They went up in smoke. So, Gary, give us some more history on this matter. I don't mean the Chargers. There's no hope there. Right. I mean Bear Stearns.
At that time, I had become aware of two things. One, that the 10-K of Bear Stearns from about 2005, 2006, had described the imminent filing of a case against it by the SEC.
And the 10-K is the report that the public companies file that investors can read.
Exactly. Yeah. So we have a case ready to go against Bear Stearns for overvaluing mortgage-backed securities. Now, at this point in early 2008, this is a month before Bear Stearns failed, there's considerable concern about what impact the mortgage-backed securities are going to have. So I sent this letter. Also, I was hearing at this time that there was a high-order risk as a result of credit default swaps that had been placed with banks. So I raised the credit default swaps in this issue. I think I mentioned there was like 50 trillion or something like that, which created a risk. And all of this was in the shadows. So I suggested to, I sent this letter to both senators because there was going to be a hearing next week and I knew some of the staff and I was suggesting that this would be a good time to ask Cox what happened to that case. They blew it off. A month later, Bear Stearns failed, and it failed when Moody's downgraded its mortgage-backed securities, which caused this huge rush for the door. Senator Grassley's staff asked me to do a brief analysis of the finances, so I did, and I sent it along, and it was an investigation. They brought Cox in about a month after Bear Stearns had failed, and they said, what happened? He said it was an act of God, essentially. I mean, it was no one could expect it. Mm-hmm. So what occurred during the heart of the crisis with Bear Stearns was that Geithner went over, started sifting through the records, and found that there were two factors affecting it. Number one was Bear Stearns had this $30 billion of mortgage-backed securities off its balance sheet, subprime, that was beginning to do, you know, this downward spiral. Mm-hmm. And now Bear Stearns had a net worth of $12 billion. So you have $30 billion off the balance sheet. If those bonds lose a third of their value, Bear Stearns is insolvent. You didn't have to be a genius to figure it out. So people ran for the door. Now, the other thing that occurred was that Geithner went over and started sorting through the records and discovered $2.5 trillion in credit default swaps, basically guarantees by Bear Stearns, which was 2,000 times its net worth. Now, what you have to keep in mind is that the SEC was supposed to be tracking the solvency and liquidity of Bear Stearns. They had a unit within the SEC, the CSE unit. The CSE unit was tracking five big banks. So they would send a representative up there to chat with Bear Stearns. It's inconceivable to me that they would not have known what was going on with Bear Stearns. If you look at Bear Stearns' balance sheet, it had a 40-to-1 debt-to-equity ratio. For every dollar of investors' capital, they borrowed $40. That's extremely thinly capitalized. So the logical question, if you're an SEC staff person, investigator, going to the Bear Stearns, is you would say, what's off your balance sheet? And the answer to that would have been $30 billion in falling mortgage-backed securities, which might have raised some concerns. And what about credit default swaps? Oh, we have $2.5 trillion of those. At that point, the SEC guy's head, hair should have gone on fire. Yeah. So it was quite predictable that Bear Stearns was headed for collapse. Now, there were four other banks, Merrill, Lehman, Morgan Stanley, which was on the verge of collapse, and Goldman, which was suspected to follow, and consequently, that's when Paulson went to the Senate, put a .45 revolver to their head and said, cough up TARP, or this, we're going out into the abyss.
But that was only $787 billion. Now we're talking several trillion in out there in notional value in these credit default swaps. I mean, I saw one figure the notional value globally is about $597 trillion. So it just, this is mind-blowing money. I mean, no wonder it seems like the world is in a state of economic chaos or collapse, but...
And Joe, we've got to thank Lestat's Coffee House one more time.
Oh, we absolutely do have to thank Lestat's for being one of our prime sponsors. And unfortunately, we are running out of time.
Not one of our subprime sponsors, but one of our prime sponsors.
Our prime sponsors, Lestat's Coffee House in University Heights, Normal Heights. Please get over there and support them. Let's thank our guest, Gary Aguirre, for being with us tonight. It was a great show. And Richard, it was great being with you again tonight. And we'll see everybody next week on It's Your Money, Not Theirs.